Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. It's a beautiful day in Chicago and a great day to be alive, especially if you're a conservative and attending the Philadelphia Society 50th anniversary. A very high standard has been set for us by the preceding panels, but I have every confidence in the world and the two gentlemen to my left, they will do as well, if not better. In the wake of Barry Goldwater's crushing presidential defeat in 1964, when young conservatives like myself wondered if we had joined the losing side, and older conservatives like Frank Meyer were rationalizing that, well, after all, 27 million Americans had voted for Goldwater despite a vicious campaign of smear and fear. One far-sighted conservative warned against measuring success or failure in the battle of ideas only by the results at the voting booth. And the ISI president, Vic Milione, wrote to Gerhard Niemeyer that the critical thing was to continue to assert the importance of education, not simply politics, in shaping the course of future events. And so when Donald Lipset, ISI's Midwest director, suggested the formation of an organization that would keep ISI graduates involved in the effort to sustain and preserve ordered liberty, Milione quickly gave his approval. Voila, the Philadelphia Society. Our panel has been asked to examine the road ahead for conservatives in the realm of politics. But as Santayana and others have commented, you must study the past in order to chart the future. So let's begin, if you'll allow me, with the candidate who seems so out of touch with the great majority of the American electorate. I believe that Barry Goldwater is the most consequential loser in modern American politics. And now let me see if I can prove that. His enduring influence is due to two things: his seemingly disastrous run for the presidency in 1964, and his 1960 political manifesto, The Conscience of a Conservative. Goldwater lost so badly to President Lyndon Johnson, who received 61% of the popular vote. By the way, that's a record. No one has ever gotten more than Lyndon Johnson got in the popular vote in 1964. And also, LBJ carried 44 states. Well, looking at these results, pundits declared that the defeat marked the end of conservatism as a political idea. It was, they said, stone cold dead with a golden stake in the heart. And yet, the Goldwater campaign inspired thousands of young conservatives, including our still most immediate past president, Ed Fulner, to enter politics. And by the way, it's quite a contrast that both Ed Fulner of Heritage and Ed Crane of Cato were both for Goldwater in 1964. Ed Crane as head of students for Goldwater at UC Berkeley, and Fulner, the same thing for Goldwater at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. And those young conservatives went on to sit in Congress, manage campaigns, head think tanks, edit magazines, host radio, TV talk shows, and raise money for a panoply of candidates and causes. Young people loved Goldwater's stubborn, principled individualism. and his independence, and his willingness in an age of PC to offer a conservative choice and not a liberal echo. Goldwater's most immediate impact, political impact, was his approval of a nationally televised speech by a semi-retired TV Hollywood actor named Ronald Reagan. Now, the political writers David Broder and Stephen Hess called Reagan's thoughtful address the most successful national political debut since William Jennings Bryan and the 1896 Democratic Convention. California Republicans admitted they would not have approached Reagan to run for governor of California if not for a time for choosing. In political shorthand, one can say, no presidential candidate Goldwater, no President Reagan. And although he was a college dropout, Goldwater never got beyond his freshman year. Goldwater believed in the power of ideas. He was comfortable around intellectuals, and members of the Philadelphia Society contributed significantly to his presidential campaign, including Harry Jaffa, Russell Kirk, Stephen Pisoni, Richard Ware, Warren Nutter, and others. Then a professor at Ohio State, for example, Professor Jaffa, drafted Goldwater's famous acceptance speech with the iconic lines, "Extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice, and let me remind you that moderation in the pursuit of justice is no virtue." That was written by Harry Jaffa, not by Goldwater's usual ghostwriter, Carl Hess. What about Russell, Russell Kirk? Russell wrote Goldwater's address at, where else, Notre Dame, in which the senator quoted Orestes Bronson, surprise, Cardinal Manning, Abraham Lincoln, and Edmund Burke, of course, as he, Goldwater, argued for the superiority of the American dream over Marxism-Leninism, not because we can build better tractors or space capsules, but because America, quote, has for its moral object the high dignity of man, and for its political aim, ordered freedom, liberty under God, and under the law, with justice for all. And Jaffa, with help from a young Phoenix lawyer named William Rehnquist, you may, that name mean something to some of the older members of this audience, happened to be a former, we should say a later Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. So Jaffa and Rehnquist wrote Goldwater's speech before the American Political Science Association, which was boycotted by many of its members. By the way, that was held here in Chicago. But those who attended gave Goldwater a standing ovation, true, a standing ovation for his insights into what? The critical role of federalism, without which there can be no true union. Federal power, indefinitely extended, Goldwater warned, quote, crushes the concurrent powers of the states in one field or another until the states have no will and finally no resources, moral or financial, of their own. In the fall of 1994, almost 30 years to the day after Goldwater was routed, a Gallup poll found that 64% of Americans agreed with the Republicans' contract with America. The public wanted what? They wanted smaller government, lower taxes and spending, tougher anti-crime measures, and less Washington meddling in their lives. Every one of those ideas was first proposed by Barry Goldwater in his 1964 campaign. As George Will wrote, Goldwater was just 30 years too early. But Goldwater would not have been nominated without the publication of a conscience of a conservative. Now, yes, Goldwater's little book doesn't pretend to be a philosophical treatise. It's light years away from the thought of Leo Strauss or Carl Vogelin, Eric Vogelin. But it is a primer on conservatism. Call it Conservatism 101. It was precisely what was needed by an emerging movement, not quite sure what it was or where it was going in 1960. Conscience argues that America is fundamentally a conservative nation, that the American people yearn for a return to conservative principles. It dismisses the liberal notion that conservatism is out of date, remarking, well, that's like saying that the Golden Rule or the Ten Commandments or Aristotle's Politics are out of date. The conservative approach, argues Goldwater, quote, is nothing more or less than an attempt to apply the wisdom and experience and the revealed truths of the past to the problems of today. Could you ask for a better explanation of conservatism for the everyday American? Now, let me say here that yes, The Conscience of a Conservative was written by L. Brent Bozell Jr., Goldwater's favorite ghostwriter. But I can attest from my research and writing a book about Barry Goldwater years later that the book is based on the speeches and positions long held by the senator, and that Bozell showed every draft chapter to Goldwater, who read and approved them all. Conscience is not just a list of public policy recommendations, fated to soon fade. It describes the philosophy undergirding the recommendations. Unlike the liberal, Goldwater writes, the conservative believes that man is not only an economic creature, but a spiritual creature, and, quote, looks upon the enhancement of man's spiritual nature as the primary concern of political philosophy. Summing up, Goldwater says that the conservative looks upon politics as, quote, the art of achieving the maximum amount of freedom for individuals that is consistent with the maintenance of social order. Tragically, he writes, the balance between freedom and order has tipped against freedom practically everywhere on earth. And so the day's overriding political challenge is to preserve and extend freedom. And yes, freedom is in peril in America, he warns, because leaders and members of both political parties, have ignored and misinterpreted the most important document in American government, the Constitution. The result is a Leviathan, a vast national authority, out of touch with the people and out of their control. The Conscience of a Conservative resonated with Americans apprehensive about the direction of the country. It sold 3.5 million copies. 3.5 million, that's even more copies than Rush Limbaugh is able to sell with his, or Barack Obama, or anybody else. It became required reading in political science courses at Harvard and other universities. It inspired young men and women to pick up and read The Conservative Mind, Ideas Have Consequences, The Road to Serfdom, and The Federalist. It was the fusionist thought of the Conscience of a Conservative and the daring thrust of his presidential campaign that fixed Barry Goldwater in the hearts and minds of conservatives. He was that rare creature in Washington, a politician who took ideas seriously, who believed in them and their power to change history. The political historian Theodore White wrote, quote, again and again in American history, it's happened that the losers of the presidency contributed almost as much to the permanent tone and dialogue of politics, as did the winners. So it's been with Barry Goldwater, who is, and I will continue to argue, the most consequential loser in modern American politics. Now it's my pleasure to introduce our two panelists. First, an action intellectual, first class with Oak Leaf Cluster. Professor Emeritus of International Relations at Boston University, former research fellow at the Hoover Institution, senior staff member for the U.S. Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, foreign service officer, U.S. naval officer, the author of 13 books and numerous articles and op-eds in the most distinguished journals and newspapers here and abroad. And let me, I've just learned that his latest book is coming out in May 1st, To Make and Keep Peace Among Ourselves and with Other Nations, coming from Stanford Press. Consultant to assorted companies and think tanks, possessors of one of the sharpest political minds and tongues in America. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Professor Angelo Cordovella.